In this four-part mini-series of Judaism Unbound, we're learning about and experiencing firsthand a fascinating Yiddish book called Bovobuch. This mini-series is presented in partnership with Theater Dibbuk, a Los Angeles-based organization that creates provocative performances and innovative educational encounters, exploring Jewish thought to illuminate universal human experience. Learn more about their work at www.theaterdibbuk.org. That's www.theaterdibbuk.org.
A long time ago, there lived in Lombardy.
The king looked him over from top to bottom and then had him trot up and down.
So she set off for the city, riding faster than an arrow.
So that they might seize and bind Bovo.
She shouted out to them, and when the sailors saw what...
And as I held him in my arms, his spirit left him.
Take everything you want and do not suppose I'll deny you anything.
Now the highborn king had a beautiful 18-year-old daughter. No man nor woman ever had a finer figure or a more splendid body. Her eyes were like two flashing garnets. She was indescribably lovely. People called her Drusiana the Fair. One day, she saw Bovo riding across the square, and she noticed how well he rode his horse. He could use his spurs to make it jump 3 feet off the ground. The whole town was looking at him. The noble maiden said to her ladies-in-waiting, "May I fall down out of this window if in all my life I ever saw a more handsome fellow?" And then she thought to herself, "Oh God, isn't he the most beautiful boy? What money and possessions I'd give to have a husband like that! His beauty has made me sick with desire, but if he were here at my side, he'd cure me soon enough. If I don't see him again, I don't know what I'll do." One Sunday morning, when Bovo and some companions went out riding, Drusiana sighed and looked at him with loving eyes. Her heart was burning for him, and she had decided to woo him.
Welcome to Bovobuch, Chivalric Romance, Cultural Collision. This is Aaron Henney, Artistic Director of Theater Dibbuk. This second episode in our three-part series investigates the role of women in the text, and the ways in which the book speaks to their position in the surrounding culture. And now, Episode 2, The Women and Their World. As we think about gender and sexuality, can you share with us a bit about the gender dynamics in general of the 16th century in Italy and Europe?
Sure. So when I was thinking about gender and gender dynamics in the early modern Italian and early modern European context, my mind went to a woman named Joan Kelly, who in the 1970s formulated a really important question. And she asked, did women have a renaissance? I mean, we know there were queens, right? Queen Elizabeth, Queen Henrietta Maria, queens in France, queens in Spain, queens in England, who are doing a formidable job leading their country. And yet, when we think about the more normal people, more average people, the question is, did that extend to them? So the reality of most people, really, says Joan Kelly and say subsequent researchers, was that women didn't really have as much social and political power as men. And in some cases, they had less than they would have had in the medieval and feudal system for a combination of reasons. And this, of course, should be nuanced. It's not like this was globally true of everyone, but in general. So we look to places such as Venice or Italy to find those exceptions. And for example, in Venice, of course, there were these women who worked as courtesans, who were learned women and had more power than the average woman, but of course, oftentimes used sex and sexuality in order to gain that power. And of course, there were many learned daughters of scholars living throughout Europe, and they did receive an education, but they were, on the whole, exceptions to the rule. Of course, lower class working women were forced to work, so it's not like that they stayed home, but they didn't do that by choice necessarily. So they did participate in the economy, but they didn't really have an active social and political role. So again, you know, when we look to the exceptions to this, we think about theater and theater in Italy in particular, where women in the middle of the 1500s and especially in the 1560s, women do have a role as company leaders in the Commedia dell'arte, which is a professional company of theater that is developing starting in the 1540s in Italy and in northern Italy specifically, with set characters and improvisation. And in that context, women did have a certain degree of power. So now let's turn it a little bit closer to Beauvau Bouche. There we see that the gender dynamics in the representation of women are also reflective somewhat of this larger reality around us. So first woman character we're presented with is Brandonia, right? This is Beauvau's mom. She's a wicked woman in many, many ways, but she's one who follows her own heart, which is very interesting. So when her parents want to marry her off to the old, decrepit Count Guidon, she's like, well, I don't like this. And she agrees for a moment, but then she contrives to have Guidon killed, right? And she takes on a lover, Count Dodon, who's going to do this dirty deed for her. So she's a little bit unusual in that sense, right? And her lines also are memorable, and they underscore the fact that she's taking a little bit of a different take here. Even though she's supposedly a count's daughter, she laments her faith with a big
hoi vai,
Yiddish style. And then she curses her parents.
May God give them both a hillach. The diarrhea.
A horrible thing. But it underscores the fact that she's disobedient in that sense. Our next heroine that we meet in Beauvau Bouche is Drusiana, an equally unusual character, and doesn't perform the role of an obedient daughter quite as well as maybe we would have assumed. So here she is, a beautiful girl. She's described as being about 18 years old, the daughter of King Erminio of Armonia. And when she first appears, she's, you know, described as Drusiana the Fair. We have this idea of her as pretty and also demure. But the moment she sees this guy Beauvau, she throws caution to the wind and is swayed by her own desire rather than her father's desire that she should marry, you know, somebody else. And she pursues her desire. Another unusual element here. And then sex and love don't end with Drusiana, because Beauvau's travels take him to a fictionalized version of Babel or Babylonia. And there he meets a Muslim woman, and she's the Sultan's daughter. And this is Margherita, also described in the text, by the way, as Margherita the Fair. And of course, she falls in love with him. They all do.
Now, the Sultan had a daughter called Margherita the Fair. She had not been in the city when all this was happening. Rather, she and her attendants had set out that morning and had spent the entire day hunting. It was evening now, and as she was riding homeward, she saw many men in the distance. She rode over to them and saw the handsome lad in their midst. She looked at him, marveled greatly, and said, "What a pity it would be if he should be hanged. I'll go see if I can't do something to save his life." And so she set off for the city, riding faster than an arrow from the bowstring. She dismounted, ran up to her father, and threw herself at his feet. He said,
"Arise, and you shall have whatever it is you desire."
Margherita said, "For what reason are you having that worthy youth killed?" The Sultan said,
"Shall I tell you? Alas, this is the very man who struck your brother dead."
"If he struck my brother dead, then he must be a mighty warrior indeed. Who knows, maybe my brother brought it upon himself. This one most likely had to fight to defend himself and managed to win. Dear father, listen to me. Let it be for now. In return, I promise you that I'll use all my wit and cunning to get him to renounce his own religion and accept ours." The Sultan said,
"If he does that, then for your sake, I'll let him live."
Margherita rejoiced and quickly dashed away, intent on saving Beauvau's life.
In an echo of Pharaoh's daughter who saves baby Moses, she also saves young Beauvau, who's imprisoned by her father, and she turns her back on her father, Medea-like, right, and is willing to betray her father and her family and her homeland for love. Drusiana and Margherita, you can think of them as daughters who are disobedient and wives. And, you know, they are supposed to follow the lens through which we look at women at the time. They're supposed to be governed by the will of the men in their lives, but they take matters into their own hands in this narrative. And that's to me, very interesting that you have such unruly women that are playing a starring role throughout the narrative. You have no demure women, and women play a very central function in this narrative all throughout.
Take him away and let me never see him again.
But Margarita said, No, wait, this must not be. Rather, keep him in the dungeon for a while. There's no way he can escape from there. The Sultan said,
Very well. For your sake, I'll give him a reprieve.
We have to keep in mind that, of course, Elia Levita writes in his foreword that he's writing this for women readers to have something to do on Shabbos and on Yom Tov, you know, on these holidays where you're not supposed to be writing, you're not supposed to be doing any work. So perhaps he is appealing to his readership in creating these strong, willful female characters. Perhaps this is a bit of a case of wish fulfillment, you know, allowing women to have an outlet which maybe they otherwise wouldn't.
I, Elia Levy, the writer, humble servant of all pious women, am troubled that several ladies counted ill of me that I have not published some of my Yiddish books for them so that they might read them on the Sabbath and on holidays, and thus amuse themselves. Indeed, it does seem right and proper that I should now do this, since I have already composed, published, and sent out into the world 8 or 9 books in the Holy Language.
And that's interesting also to think about in terms of potentially the roles that women played in the Italian community, which was, as we already discussed, a very heterogeneous Jewish community composed both of Ashkenazim, but also of Sfaradim and also of Italiani, and where women took a role in the businesses that their husbands and that their fathers handled. And sometimes in the wills of these men, you see that they're leaving their businesses not to sons. Sometimes they didn't have sons, but sometimes to daughters and sometimes to widows. And that is very interesting. So there were a lot of very able women working in the Jewish Italian community. And Levita may have been very aware of the fact that that's the kind of woman he's writing for.
Even with the desire to appeal to these strong women, the trappings of the time can't be escaped, as evidenced when Margarita, much like Brandonia before her, is due to marry a figure she does not love. She must turn to the male hero, Bovo, for help in this matter.
One day, about half a year later, as Bovo was sitting playing chess with Sinibald, a letter arrived. In it, the fair Margarita had written to him of many remarkable events. Her father, the Sultan, had died, and she was now all alone. The Lord Pashamont had almost driven her from her lands and was causing her unimaginable sorrows. He also wanted her to be his wife. She had heard of how things had gone well for Bovo and hoped that he would now share his good fortune with her and help her out of her distress. She would but remind him of the kindness and devotion she had shown to him when he had been imprisoned in her father's dungeon, and if it came to pass that he were able to drive away Pashamont, then she would gladly become his wedded wife.
And now, in another example of women's position in this society being inseparable from their identification as wives who live in service of their husband's needs, we'll hear a moment in the text where Margarita's desire to wed Bovo gets tied together with a willingness to convert to his Jewish religion.
Then she led him into her palace. After all the warriors had taken off their armor, she held a great banquet in their honor. When all had eaten and had had their fill, Margarita turned to Bovo and said, Do you remember how I once asked you to accept my religion and how you refused? I'll accept yours now, if you want me for your wife. Bovo said,
If you'll do that, I'll take you most gladly. We'll have a splendid wedding, but let's wait for a month or so I'll have time to announce it throughout the world. I'll invite princes and lords.
Then she pledged herself to him, and he pledged himself to her, and everyone went off to bed.
One scholar, this is Howard Edelman, who's written about the question of literacy of Jewish women in early modern Italian communities, and he shows that there were ambivalent attitudes towards women and women reading. And he points already to the Bible, right? And in the Bible, you know, we're told that you should teach the commandments to your banecha. Okay, banecha, is that sons specifically? Or is that banecha your children? So Edelman shows that Talmudic interpretations veered towards understanding it as explicitly your sons, and Mishnayah interpretations may have leaned a little bit more towards understanding that it could include daughters as well. So already from the beginning, you have this kind of ambivalence. And then if we look historically at what's going on the ground, you see that ambivalence absolutely reflected in terms of people that we know who had literacy and people who probably did not. So knowledge and literacy were connected to female promiscuity. So if you can read, you become a little more dangerous because who knows what you can read and, you know, who knows where that'll take you, right? And assimilation, as we know, was already an issue and a factor. And women have such an important role, especially in terms of Judaism and in terms of the halacha, because if your mother is Jewish, you are considered Jewish. And so it's very important to preserve that connection for women and the religion. So you've got this connection of sexuality, promiscuity, and literacy, and the fear of that. But still, you have many examples of very honorable and very famous Jewish women who were very literate. One example that comes to mind is Sarah Kopia Sulam, who lived in Venice and who led a salon for Jewish and non-Jewish thinkers to come and to visit in the middle of the ghetto in Venice. Another famous woman is Donia Gracia Nessi, who was coming from a Sephardic background, and Benvenita Abravanel, big business women who worked in their family's businesses and involved themselves in trade and banking and money, and they were very literate. I think about Leona de Somi, the playwright, our first Jewish playwright, who dedicates a beautiful bilingual poem he writes in defense of women, Magen Nashim. So, you know, working women had oftentimes were taught to read at home by leading rabbis, for example, or people who came to the home. Edelman himself also notes that there were Jewish women who taught young girls in Italian and even in Hebrew, he notes, and that there were women who were in charge of the education also of young men in the family. After all, they played that role too. As women who went on pilgrimages, one presumes that they were also reading all kinds of texts as they were doing that. And there were women who read the Bible and who even led services for other women. You know, how rampant was this? What were the percentages? It seems like there was a real spectrum of possibilities and a wide one. Clearly, there was ambivalence, but the ambivalence led both ways. So some were favorable and some were less favorable. Now, Hannah Tonyansky and Erica Tim have this important book about Yiddish texts in Italia. And in that book, you have a series of republications of colophones. Colophones are title pages, pages of text where you refer to the publisher. And in these colophones from different books, you have a lot of Yiddish texts published in Italy and read by Italian Jewish women that were dedicated specifically to women of the 1500s, 1600s. So these could be books of commandments, for example. These could be siddurs for women. For example, you have a book called Seder Nashim, a book in which there you have all kinds of commandments for women, things that women should do. And you have a book called Mitzvot Nashim, Blessings and Other Commandments that Women Should Do. You have also books of Minhagim. Minhagim are customs books. And these are written in Yiddish. So presumably they're written for somebody to read, right? So to return to Bovo Buch, interestingly, though you have characters as the sons and daughters of counts and people who are aristocrats, Drusiano and Bovo always identify as Jews. And so, to me, it sounds like Drusiana hangs even closer to her Jewish identity than Bovo does.
And as surely as I'm a Jew, that handsome lad she has with her is Bovo.
She's the one, for example, who insists on a bris for her boys. And the women and the characters there are really appealing to a female audience.
Her father said,
"Dear daughter, I beg you, let God guide all things. Henceforth and forevermore, be pious and conduct yourself honorably. Forsake your foolish ways, and people will forgive you what you have done. Then may you grow old with dignity. Many a young maiden before you has gone astray."
Then Drusiana mounted a horse and left the square, riding behind her father. When the children were brought to her later, she said, "They haven't been circumcised yet." The king said,
"Never fear, I'll arrange a fine bris for tomorrow."
The next day, before the boys were taken to be circumcised, he asked Drusiana,
"Tell me, what are they to be named?"
She said, "Before my Bovo of blessed memory went away from me, he said to me every day, 'I want to name one Guidon after my father, and the other Sinibald after my guardian.'" The king said,
"Very well."
And those were the names he gave them.
So building on that, share with us a bit more about the book's relationship to appealing to women as a primary audience.
Okay, so when I was reading and rereading this text, one of the readings I gave it, I was astonished. I was noting to myself all of the references to issues that I would connect with women's issues. And there I'm thinking about issues that have to do with child rearing and childbirth, and issues that have to do with food preparation and food in general. So when you get to the point in the narrative in which Drusiana has given birth, it's interesting that she's nurtured not necessarily by Bovo, but by this half dog, half man creature, Pelican. And Pelican sets out to find food for Drusiana and her new babies. And the birth sequence, in fact, actually underscores the role, the active role the Pelican takes in midwifing.
In the distance, they saw a beautiful forest. They rode into it and soon dismounted. Pelican quickly cut some branches and made a little hut on the ground. Drusiana's pains started coming more quickly, and the longer they went on, the worse it got for her.
She wept bitterly and said, "Oy vey, what shall become of me without a midwife? Oy vey, how can I have a child by myself? How shall I take care of myself? Most holy, I have none of those things which a woman in confinement must have." And Pelican said,
"Dear child, don't cry. You have me and Bovo, the handsome lad. He'll hold your back and I'll pull the child out for you."
Just as she started to lie down, a pretty baby came out. Pelican had to play the role of midwife and receive the child. And so she had a fine, pretty son, a large one, a stout one, a long one. But then she cried, "Oy vey, I'm going to have more. I think there's still another one stuck inside me." And no sooner had she said the words when she had another pretty lad.
When he finds food for them, he finds it in a monastery. And the food that he describes would do really well in a cooking show. I mean, it's mouth-watering kind of food. Rice and wheat, he says. And he's taking tzimukim, little raisins, and grapes. And he's taking spices. I mean, a readership of men, would that really be that interesting for them at this time? Chefs today who are men, yes, absolutely. But early modern men who are probably not going to find themselves cooking for their family, I don't think so. But a woman readership could already start to imagine what kind of things you could cook with those. And that's exactly what the narrative then does. Then the narrative describes the facts that he takes these ingredients, right? And he takes a pot of fat and salt, that schmaltz, right? And the narrative has him taking a sack of bread, and then now things go wild. He now takes smoked tongues, and then he uses boiled down wine to create. I mean, this is very specific. It's almost like a recipe book.
The reading you are about to hear was also shared in episode 1, when we were discussing the importance of food in the text. We, however, wanted to share it with you once again, with this framing, specific to the gender dynamics present in the work.
Then he went into a building where he found many chickens in a coop. He said,
"I'll take all of those."
The monks dared not say a word. Then he found a chest full of rice, wheat, raisins, grapes, and figs, as well as a whole sack full of spices. He gathered together some cooked things as well. Then he took a great pot of fat and a bag of salt, stuffed a sack full of bread, and took down some smoked tongues from where they had been hanging next to the fireplace. He found a cask of boiled down wine. It was so old the hoops were about to pop off the barrel. And he said,
"We can drink that."
He gathered all this in a heap, and then he took all manner of kitchen utensils, platters, spoons, plates, a pot or two, like those you pay 3 hellers for, and a pan for cooking eggs in. Then he went down into the cellar and drew off 2 large bottles of wine. He also took with him a bucket in which to wash the baby's diapers.
Again, who would find this interesting? Well, maybe somebody who actually finds themselves in the kitchen or administrating over a kitchen. I mean, this would be something that would appeal to somebody who really knows what those details are. In addition to emphasizing the meals, I want to say that the narrative of the childbirthing, the nursing, early child care, which runs several pages in the book. I mean, it's not just one sentence. It's several pages of this.
The next morning, she quickly got up and ran around the hut like a mad woman, gathering up all the children's things. She sucked two fresh eggs, nursed the babies, and then tied one onto her back and took the other in her arms. She said, "God have mercy, why didn't I do as my father and mother said, those fine, worthy people?"
Then turns to questions that are really specific, such as swaddling of a baby, you know, wrapping up a baby tightly, and what kind of cloths you should use, and diapers, and how you should clean the diapers. I mean, very specific details for women who are mothers, for women who are midwives, for women who have had births in the family. This would be very familiar details. And you'd want to hear about these details. You'd be interested in these details and you'd find them fascinating. Now, I want to turn to another aspect that I think, again, when I was reading this, thinking about who are the intended listeners or readers of this text, I want to say that I think there's a lot about female interiority in this text. The emotional landscape of your inner thoughts, of your changing ideas, of your moods. And I think this is very evident with Drusiana, who, you know, of course, this is called the Bovo Buch. We're supposed to be focusing on Bovo all the time, but we hear quite a lot about Drusiana.
Let's let Bovo sail many a mile and go his long, long way while I sing to you now of what had been happening in the meantime to the dear Drusiana. When Bovo again failed to appear, Drusiana grew deeply troubled. She went throughout the palace, anxiously asking everyone if they knew anything at all, but no one could tell her a thing. Greatly concerned, she could hardly wait until the next day came. Then she went to her father and said, "Dear father, help me. Things can't go on like this with Bovo. I'm afraid he's been killed. Please keep silent no longer. Don't take this so lightly. You should make a royal inquiry, heralded by trumpets, asking if anyone has seen him." The king said,
"I'm almost afraid that someone somewhere has taken his life, but I'll not rest until I find out what really happened to him. This weighs heavily on my heart, for I cherish that worthy hero. Therefore, dear daughter, you have my permission to undertake an inquiry just as you wish."
Drusiana left and quickly went to draft a suitable proclamation. It stated that if anyone who had any part in Bovo's death by word or by deed should now name his accomplices, then he would be granted amnesty, earn the eternal gratitude and favor of the king, and receive an award of 1,000 ducats. Drusiana ordered this proclamation read repeatedly on the city squares and in all the streets.
Drusiana at one point is described as melancholic because she senses a premonition of misfortune. That's such a beautiful and nuanced and subtle kind of quality that she senses that. And I think that, you know, for people who are in their worlds doing tasks, but in their thoughts, that must have been a commonly shared kind of experience. This description, again, suggests things that the reader might have identified with, but things that it would have been hard to speak about to other people. But when you hear the narration about this, there's a lot of sensitivity and an understanding that his female readership, that this might resonate with them. The narrative spends a lot of time also describing how she feels when she grows troubled and that she feels anxious and that she's restless, for example. Not just actions, but also the interiority.
When Drusiana saw all this, she began to weep and wail, for she feared Bovo was also dead, torn apart by the lions, just like Pelican. She said, "If I wait here, I might be killed as well. The lion is sure to come back, following our scent. Even so, I will wait the rest of this day for Bovo. But if he doesn't come back today, then I'll leave here and go back to my mom and dad." She wept and carried on piteously as she waited for the whole day in the hut with the children.
Along with this interiority, we have a kind of mirroring of her Jewish identity, which strengthens as she becomes more and more in touch with her own feelings. And it seems to me that she comes to expressions. She's had the oy veis early in the text, but now she gets to curses such as Yimach Shmam V'zichram, may they be cursed, may their names be cursed and their memories cursed. So her Yiddishness and her interiority seem to me connected. And these female characters, they do seem to be touching on both emotions and Jewishness in a way that's different from the male characters.
She ran over hill and dale until she came out of the forest. The children screamed and wailed the whole time. Her sorrows were great indeed. Then she ran across the fields and meadows, not knowing where she was going, until she saw a shepherd off in the distance. This heartened her, and she hurried over to him and said, "Tell me, where is the nearest town?" The shepherd said,
"Sit down and rest a while with your children, and after a while I'll take you to that path over there and show you the way to a fine city."
So she sat down next to him alongside a brook. He smiled amorously at her and began to make advances thus and thus. He wanted her for himself. She said, "May your name and memory be blotted out forever. How dare you think such a thing of me?" The shepherd said,
"Don't think ill of me. A man may try, a woman may refuse."
So now we're going to shift to something really fun. We're gonna talk about sexuality in the text, which seems, to my eyes, to follow some familiar ideas of love and romance while also upending them, allowing for both passion and modesty in different places. So I would love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yes. Well, and it might surprise us to think that we can experience sexuality in Yiddish, you know, in this narrative from the early modern period, but that is very apparent, I think, here in this. So when Drusiana first sees Bovo, she's taken by his looks.
She would have gladly jumped down to him had he shown the least interest in her, but Bovo did not seem to notice any of her smiles and waves and just went on his way. As he rode off, she gave a great sigh and almost fainted. She longed for him so much that she could neither eat nor drink.
And Elia Levita is not afraid to give us a very lustful picture of a young woman who wants to get physical with this guy. She literally makes eyes at him, but he, of course, remained lovely, cool, and unresponsive. And the narrative becomes very comical at this point. You've got this very heated young woman and this guy who's kind of clueless and doesn't really get it or is not interested in her at all.
How quickly did Drusiana send for him? When that fine fellow came, she glanced at him lovingly and looked him all over from head to toe and immediately felt much revived. Then she whispered into his ear, "Thou lovely visage, thou bright star, serve me and wait on my table."
"As you wish," said Bovo.
Everyone then sat down at the tables and the various courses were brought out, boiled and broiled chicken and fish. But Drusiana ate not a bite during the entire meal. She could not take her eyes off Bovo. The more she longed for him, the worse she felt, and it was not for food that she hungered. Her passion soon became so obvious that everyone in the room noticed it and started saying to one another,
"Look how indecently she's carrying on over that runaway stable boy."
But Drusiana was determined to fulfill her desire, and so she deliberately dropped her knife so that it fell under the table.
Bovo came at once, told the ladies-in-waiting to remain seated, and got down on his hands and knees to look for it.
Drusiana immediately bent down and said, "Are you blind? Don't you see it?" And as he reached under the table for it, she kissed him.
Bovo jumped, rubbed his cheek, and was terribly embarrassed when he heard the others schmuessen. "How naughty! She dropped that knife on purpose!" He was also afraid that the people at the next table had seen everything, and he cast down his eyes and blushed redder than a glowing ember. Soon the meal was over, and they all got up from their tables and went over to thank the hostess. Bovo, too, wanted to do what was proper, and so he went to take his leave of Drusiana. But he was so embarrassed, he could scarcely speak. He did manage to say, "God bless thee, noble lady. Forgive me that I can stay no longer, but I must go shovel horse manure."
His words lacked a certain polish. But she said, "Go then, dear one. May God watch over you and reward you for having served me so well."
She's described amidst schmuessen. Everybody's gossiping about her because she's obviously not controlling herself at all at how much she's gaga over this guy, and he just is totally oblivious. So finally, after pages and pages of delayed gratification, she grows so turned on, really, that she's described as so desperate and wanting him that she contrives a way to find herself in a barn with him alone, right? And the guy lies down, Bovo, and basically tells her, "I've got to sleep. I'm exhausted." And she literally has a line that says, "All right, come on, you've slept enough." And she kind of, you know, she really provokes him into action and entices him.
Drusiana wanted Bovo more now than ever. She could not get him out of her mind. And now that no one was around, everyone had gone home to eat, she went to where he lay, sleeping on the hay. He was lying on his back, sleeping sweetly, his cheeks all rosy. She sat there admiring him for a while, and then she grabbed one of his feet and tugged on it until she woke him up. She spoke most lovingly to him. "Come on, you've slept enough. Sit here next to me, proud warrior." And Bovo thought,
"What a strange thing to say," and said, "What is it you wish, noble young lady?"
She said, "How often these past weeks have I waved and beckoned to you, but you never so much as looked at me. Yet if I hadn't been at the tournament today, you would have been hacked to bits."
Bovo would have gladly gone somewhere else, but she held him tightly and wouldn't let him go.
She said, "You are my heart's desire. Why do you turn your back on me? If you only knew how fond I am of you, you'd cuddle up closer to me. Oh, why are you so stubborn? You're breaking my heart. I'm really not all that ugly. I do have a nice pair of tits." With that, she burst out laughing, bared her two snow-white breasts, and said, "Come on now, don't be so shy. Surely these are not two morsels to be refused."
But of course, in the text, it takes them a little bit longer until they actually can consummate their attraction. So it's only later on that he and Drusiana finally actualize their desire and have sex. And that sex is described in the text. The description is interesting because the sex happens after a prolonged description of Bovo saddling his horse. And his horse is called Rondella, which has a kind of feminine name to it.
What we are about to listen to is the introduction of the horse that Arete mentions. You will also hear talk of a sword.
Then she gave him the sword, Pomela, and the horse, Rondella.
The sword, which reached down to his calf, was a most excellent one. It was so sharp, one could have shorn hair with it, or even split a thread. The horse was enchanted, and no weapon could harm it. It was possessed with the devil's own power and could defend itself against 100 men. Now that he was ready, Bovo quickly jumped onto the horse.
Drusiana cried and said to him, "Go forth, dear, worthy warrior, and may Almighty God go with you, he who did create heaven and earth. Now bend down here to me a little." She kissed him on the mouth.
He kissed her back.
And he's saddling the horse for a long time, and then he comes inside, and then he eats. Food is important again. And then, finally, after arming himself and eating, they finally, in the text, are described as taking pleasure with each other. And Drusiana cries as though she's come upon a thief in the stables, but this thief stabbed her without a struggle, and she offered no resistance.
As soon as Drusiana had come into the stable, he jumped into the saddle, swung her up behind him, and rode away as fast as an arrow. They rode without stopping that whole night, and for a good while into the next day as well.
After they had ridden 70 miles, they came to a great forest. In it they found an extraordinarily beautiful spring, and here they dismounted to rest a while in the sun. They ate what few provisions they had brought along, and soon felt quite refreshed.
Then,
for the first time,
they took their pleasure with each other.
Drusiana cried out as though she had come upon a thief in the stables, but this thief stabbed her without a struggle, for she offered no resistance.
I think you know what I mean.
The female cries, one imagines cries of enjoyment, could be overheard or taken to be cries of assault or rape, which is very interesting to me that that's the way it's being framed, and it's sort of being framed in this couched and cloaked way, right? You refer to this mixture of sexuality and conservatism that is occurring. And there is this way in which the copiousness is halted at a certain point. In other words, the sexual descriptions do not become copious, as opposed to, let's say, the food descriptions, which absolutely do. And that might indicate this place in which, we got to shroud this a little bit. We've got to cool this off a little bit. And the suggestiveness is important, but we don't want to go into further details. And so I think that's very interesting.
It is interesting to think about also as you speak about the moment in film or TV where they shift the camera to the curtains. and we know what's occurring, but we don't get to bear witness. And to think about also the stereotypes, whether true or not, that go with what a male viewership or readership wants to receive and what a female readership or viewership wants to receive, right? That there are these cultural assumptions, I think, that sometimes are about the kind of details of it might be of less interest to a female readership, which may or may not be accurate, I want to say. And there's also, I'm sure, rules of propriety at that time that are not exactly the same as our current rules of propriety.
Right, right. And, you know, as opposed to writers like Ariosto or Aretino at the time, I think the Jewish writers have to be careful. And, you know, even though they're writing sometimes for a readership that's mixed, they can cater to a certain degree to humanist or early modern or Renaissance fashion. But at the end of the day, they come home to their Jewish community. And they have to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, if they've overstepped, if they've been too provocative, that might become problematic. That speaks to, you know, a more conservative readership and also a danger that exists, I think, for the Jew in the Renaissance, in this early modern period, for whom, you know, liberties are always a little bit limited. And so there's always the possibility that you could be censored, that you could be punished. And even though that exists, of course, to some extent for the Christian writer or creator, you have that additional element of living as a marginalized person within a community that exists as others. And so you have an additional layer of challenges that you have to face, I think, at this period.
It gets me thinking about the sort of freedom of overstepping that if you are in the dominant culture, one can have, like, oh, that may cause me a problem or it may be seen as negative, but I'm not necessarily in the same degree of danger for both my life, my belonging, whatever it may be, as those in the marginalized groups. So I want to think about now, we've moved from sexuality through questions of assimilation, integration, what's allowed, what's not. And that leads me to think about this challenging sequence near the end of the piece where a female figure who wants to marry Bova Buch is easily, how shall we say, transferred to a different husband. Mm-hmm. Share about this and the way at which it operates, how it might have been received as well.
So yes, so in the narrative, I've talked so much about Drusiana, but there's another woman and she's there for large swaths of narrative too. And this is during his time in Babel, right? A kind of like a Babylon kind of place. And he is taken in by the Sultan and eventually is imprisoned and then escapes. There he meets Margarita the Fair, who is described as of a heathen religion and she's described as Muslim. She falls in love with him as well, just like Drusiana does. And she helps him, as we've said already before. While he's with her, he's also reunited at some point in the narrative with Drusiana. Drusiana has kind of fallen away because he was taken and he lost connection with Drusiana. And when he loses the connection with Drusiana, the interesting thing is that in the narrative, Bovo doesn't lament that. He just forgets. He moves on. And he moves on to Margarita. And when he's with Margarita, he stipulates that she should convert, right? Early on when they meet each other, she tells him, convert to my religion and come and live with me and you'll be accepted by Father. He says, absolutely not. I reject it. Later in the narrative, when they meet again, he says to her, well, you want to be with me, you got to convert. And she says, okay, I will convert. Which is really interesting, I think. And she seems to convert very easily, and even her ability to use words shifts immediately, and she starts using Yiddish upon agreeing to convert. They're just about to get married, I mean, Margarita and Bovo, and then Drusiana reappears. And in the text, her horror is amplified because Levita tells us Margarita was horrified when she heard that Bovo's first wife has returned to him. And she falls down as though she's dead. And Bovo actually tries to revive her at this incredible moment. And she tells her to accept God's will, right? He invokes God, which is interesting. And in a few sentences, he immediately switches her over to somebody else. He says, well, you know what? You should take my comrade. You should take my friend Tiritz. He's just as good as man as I am to you, he says. And she accepts. And then she uses this fantastic concept. She says, I'll take him gladly, for I fear if things are not resolved quickly, there might be many bilbulim, confusions. I think that's really interesting that there's going to be plot confusions. It's religious confusions. It's sexual confusions.
Margarita was horrified when she heard that Bovo's first wife had returned to him. Unable to utter a word, she fell down as though she were dead. Bovo himself had to revive her. He said,
you must accept that which has now come to pass. Put all else out of your mind, and let our Lord God's will be done, as our elders have decreed one must do. But listen while I suggest something which will preserve your honor and ensure you a good and happy life. Let me give my comrade, Tiritz, to you. He is just as good a man for you as I. He's certainly no husband to be ashamed of.
Margarita said, If he wants me, then I'll take him gladly, for I fear if things are not resolved quickly, Birbulim might result. Bovo sent straight away for Tiritz, seated him next to Margarita, and made him swear their devotion to each other and promise to marry.
This is a story of a lot of partner switching, which is really provocative, frankly, and totally unexpected for, you know, a Jewish grammarian to be writing about this, you know, swaps that are happening here. And then the bilbulim idea, the confusions idea, is almost underscored by the fact that like a page later, they're going to celebrate essentially a double marriage, right? A reunification of Drusiana and Bovo and a marriage of Margarita and Tiritz. And the people who are included and invited are described in a very interesting way. They're not just Jews are invited because a lot of the characters here are not Jewish, but they're not described as goyim or goys. As Gentiles, they're described as chitzoniim, outsiders.
Then he got some new clothes for Drusiana, for there was soon to be a double wedding. First, a fine bridal canopy was erected. Then 50 minyonim, as well as a great many non-Jewish outsiders, arrived. It was a splendid wedding. There was dancing and jigs, as there always is, as well as swordplay and jousts.
Everyone had a wonderful time and was in fine spirits. The celebrations went on for 4 weeks. The two brides were both pleased, and each one content with her own husband. And, although Tiritz had a body that looked as though it might have been turned on a lathe, Drusiana would not have traded with Margarita for a second.
I think there's something very interesting about inside-outside identity, shifting identity, shifting partnership, shifting religion that's occurring here.
Even for what was said to be a female readership, there is an acceptance of, and in a way, a celebration of this easy swapping of partners, this woman being handed to another partner.
It is interesting that it is Margarita who is really compromised in the narrative, and she is not the Jewish character. She's not the one who is identified, at least in the beginning of the narrative, as the Jewish character. And so in that sense, she's probably safer to have this narrated on her rather than on Drusiana.
Which, again, as we think about who's in and who's out in our modern Jewish communities and such, it's a very problematic take.
To complicate it further, Aaron, we should note that I think Eliyahu Levita's grandsons themselves converted. So this question literally became very important in his own life.
We've talked a lot in this episode about female readership, female audience. But the piece, actually, some have argued, seemed to have transcended. It became wildly popular and seemed to have reached also a male readership. And I'd love to hear a little bit of your take on that, knowing some of this is speculative, right? But about how that happened, how it appealed to a wider and broader audience.
So we have to think that he's generating the story while he's living in Padua in northern Italy. And he's generating the story around 1507. And the original manuscript is lost, but there were two manuscript copies that were known to us. And supposedly he also used these copies and read this story out loud. And then in 1541, you've got this moment in which the text becomes published. In 1530s, you start to see Yiddish texts being published more and more frequently. And by the 1540s, 50s, 60s, this is really taking up. So that I think one book that I looked at suggested that between 1530s and 1640s, you have something like 70 Yiddish books that are being published. So you have quite a few Yiddish books that are actually coming into being. And therefore, Bovo Buch has a special place in the dissemination and the publication of Yiddish books. There's something about both the female readership, but perhaps also, as you suggest, and as others have suggested, more than just the female readership that is interested in this. You know, men, of course, are expected not to read anything except books that are concretely more tied to the Bible or religion or the Talmud. But one can imagine that there would have been an interest. The fact that rabbis were not happy about the text in various phases is an indication that they were not happy about it for a variety of reasons. One was this idea of promiscuity in female readership, but the other might be that it's not reaching just the female audience.
Thank you for listening to this second episode of Bovobuch, Chivalric Romance, Cultural Collision. The final episode will explore the book's popularity, as well as the problematic and challenging nature of its relationship to its Muslim characters, and more. This episode featured actors Julie Lockhart and Clay Steakley, with Joshua Wolfe Coleman as the author. Readings throughout the series from the English translation by Jerry C. Smith are performed by actors Joshua Wolfe Coleman, Joe Jordan, Julie Lockhart, Rebecca Rasmussen, Clay Steakley, Diana Tanaka, and Mark McLean Wilson. Mary Correll of the California Institute for Yiddish Culture and Language provided the reading of the Yiddish excerpt and guidance on Yiddish pronunciation. The music featured was composed by Salomone Rossi and performed by the Vocal Ensemble for Theater Dybbuk's production of Hell Prepared, musical director Fahed Siadat. The series is edited by Mark McLean Wilson. Scholarship is provided by Arit Jaffe Berg. The podcast is produced by Theater Dybbuk and presented in collaboration with Judaism Unbound.
And so, dear sirs, ponder this.
How quickly did Drusiana send for
him? It sorely grieved Bovo to see
Let's
so many
Let's let Bovo
of
sail many a mile.
Shout down and tell her that I won't let her
Bovo
and Bovo
now went
in
into the great hall and found it.
I haven't seen the likes of him for a long time. He must be a real fighting cock.
Staft dazu besser gesang, dem kann ich nur sagen mein Dank.